At 4 a.m. in a hospital room, fluorescent lights flickering overhead, a young doctor delivered the news that would shatter everything. Stage 4 colon cancer with a 14% survival rate. "You'd better be holding my hand if you're going to say stuff like that," Kate told him as he reluctantly explained that survival meant just 2 years. In those early morning hours, she began calculating what remained: 730 days, 2 Christmases, 2 summers, 104 Thursdays. Not enough time for anything that matters. Before this diagnosis, Kate had spent a decade studying the prosperity gospel, the belief that faith, positive thinking, and righteous living guarantee health and wealth. Now, facing her own mortality, these promises rang hollow. The best life now philosophy permeating American culture through wellness industries and self-help suddenly seemed like cruel fiction. There is, quite simply, no cure for being human. After diagnosis, home transforms as Mennonite relatives clean and prepare meals with military precision. Time becomes precious rather than a productivity metric. Wednesdays mean leaving at 3:45 a.m. for Atlanta treatments, returning at midnight with new chemotherapy packs and reports of shrinking but stubborn tumors. Harsh realities accumulate, family taking loans for what insurance denies, the clinical trial prohibiting future children, toxic chemotherapy preventing contact with a toddler. The most heartbreaking moments come during quiet hours with her son. Reading his favorite story about a mother bunny searching for her baby, she stumbles over, "Wherever you go, I will find you," knowing the future holds a place where finding him becomes impossible. Every detail of his growing body becomes cataloged: feet straining against sleepers, attempts to climb from cribs, knowing these moments might be all that remain. The world becomes unsafe for people in pain. At a friend's party, a brief escape from cancer identity shatters when someone casually reminds you you're dying. The advice to live in the moment becomes cruelly ironic when moments contain brutal treatments and doctors who refer to you as a little lab rat. Despite efforts to stay present, the future constantly interrupts. The eternal present consists of medical appointments where life-altering decisions are made with clinical detachment, like when an oncologist casually mentions he could have arranged treatment locally instead of requiring months of travel. Yet illness paradoxically brings appreciation. The mundane begins to sparkle. Holding a child or dancing with friends, moments feel eternal. Still, knowledge haunts. Will a son remember his mother? A psychologist reassures that foundations are being built, even if you might not get to see what he builds on top of it. On a ziplining adventure, a guide with her own health struggles explains that not all risks are equal, and living itself requires courage, because in the end, the hero dies. Weekly routines become mechanical rhythms of medical interventions, alternating chemotherapy and immunotherapy infusions, data gathering, and bi-monthly report cards measuring tumor status. Well-meaning counselors suggest creating bucket lists to find meaning, yet these lists have become manifestations of experiential capitalism, collecting moments like souvenirs rather than truly confronting mortality. With unlimited resources and perfect health, we could theoretically do anything, but this abundance of choice often obscures what truly matters. Caught between wanting more life while wrestling with acceptance, we become immersed in cold abstractions of blood counts and survival statistics. We lose sight of what's meaningful in favor of what's merely measurable. Mortality forces us to confront not just one final death, but the continuous deaths of possible futures throughout our lives. The fundamental question shifts from what we can accomplish before we die to what deserves our attention now with whatever time remains. Ambition has always driven me, growing up in Winnipeg's open prairies where stillness breeds restlessness. Despite ambitious not being a compliment for women, I embraced the idea that ambition meant keeping your bum in a chair for an extremely long time. At Duke University, shelves of specialized books representing years of dedication made me question whether the work demanded too much. Academia's brutal math requires accomplishing 10 things in 7 years or losing your position, with women facing the additional challenge of timing pregnancy against the tenure clock. While undergoing cancer treatment, a turning point came in Virginia Beach when academic friends discussed my unfinished research rather than my illness. When fear emerged that continuing work seemed futile given my uncertain future, a friend offered profound wisdom. If the worst happens and this book is the last thing you ever do, Zach can still find you there. This propelled me back to work. Before liver surgery, a bishop prayed, "Lord Jesus, bless these surgeons. God, if you please, keep this one alive. Her best work is yet to come." Summer becomes a time of healing from liver resection surgery with its 7-inch incision, the aftermath of exquisitely restrained violence. Unable to hold a child, I watch from the sidelines while recovering. The radiation oncologist delivers unexpected news. The remaining tumor has disappeared, becoming a pancake tumor. While family celebrates this miracle, there's recognition that people eventually stop worrying about chronic suffering, finding it difficult to sustain fear indefinitely. We experience time in 3 ways: tragic time, grappling with suffering; apocalyptic time, seeing the world's brokenness with terrible clarity; and pastoral time, ordinary rhythms most prefer. Glimpsing the apocalyptic makes it impossible to fully return to pastoral time. During a routine follow-up, a surgeon reveals scans showing a new tumor, something no one said could happen. Left alone with devastating news and radiation paperwork, the intake nurse gently asks if anyone came with me, receiving only, "It was just a follow-up." After sharing the news with loved ones and numbly following travel plans, medical reports later reveal that tumor was actually just a signal dropout in the scan, a mere fat deposit. When stability arrives, neither progressing nor regressing, understanding what this means becomes challenging. After transforming spaces and discarding outgrown items, new questions emerge. Could I have that baby? Only to learn that immunotherapy meant surrendering fertility. America's cultural aversion to regret is pervasive. Even celebrities emerging from scandals insist, "It made me who I am today." The self-help industry sells narratives of endless progress, while suffering quietly erodes life. Maintaining normalcy becomes a performance, mentioning upcoming scans casually to reassure others. Experimenting with not initiating contact reveals a painful truth. The phone goes quiet, except for a handful of calls, leaving one feeling like everyone's inspiration and no one's friend. At Portugal's Vitala Monastery, an unfinished chapel provides wisdom. 7 kings had overseen its construction, yet none lived to complete it. An elderly visitor explains, "We're never done, dear. Even when we're done, we're never done. Our masterpieces remain unfinished, our striving unnecessary. Life's magic exists alongside ordinary struggles. There is no cure for being human. We live with our limitations, our unfinished cathedrals, and hearts that keep beating despite everything, finding moments of transcendence and love that make it worthwhile, even knowing it will never be enough."